Hello and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Wednesday, May 27th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Mason City to let its emergency COVID-19 proclamation expire. The gradual reopening continues. More than 2 months since Mason City Mayor Bill Schickel proclaimed a ban on public gatherings over 10 people as a response to the COVID-19 pandemic, the mayor announced at a weekly press conference on Wednesday afternoon that that proclamation would be allowed to expire on June 1st. According to Schickel, part of the reason for the move is to better accommodate open-air dining as well as summer sports, which are allowed to resume June 15th. But with that move, Schickel made clear that not everything should change. I strongly encourage residents to wear masks and observe social distancing guidelines, Schickel said near the top of the Zoom meeting with Cerro Gordo County Department of Public Health Director Brian Hanft and Deputy Director of the University of Iowa's Injury Prevention Research Center, Lisa Roth. In addition to that urging, Schickel also made sure to tell people that as they continue to traipse towards some sense of normalcy, they still need to pay attention to state and local guidelines from public health departments. One thing Cerro Gordo Public Health has continued to do as more businesses and programs consider reopening is offer advice on distancing or processing customers. In some cases, that's meant telling people that a reopening or an event just doesn't make sense at this present time. Hanft acknowledged that having to have conversations about canceling something as big as the Clear Lake 4th of July festivities makes for the hardest part of the job, but that such moves are appropriate based on existing public health standards. Such decisions don't happen in a vacuum, and both Hanft and Schickel are aware of that. When asked about the North Iowa Fair also being canceled this week, Schickel reflected on the loss before putting it in greater context. "It's a big concern," Schickel said. "It's a loss of building community, loss of visitors, but it is nothing compared to people that are experiencing illness or experiencing death because of this pandemic." Virus review. American deaths surpass 100,000. What does a number mean? The fraught, freighted number of this particular American moment is a round one brimming with zeros, 100,000. 100,000s. 1,000 hundreds. 5,000 score. More than 8,000 dozen. All dead. This is the week when America's official coronavirus death toll reaches 6 digits. 100,000 lives wiped out by a disease unknown to science a half a year ago. And as the unwanted figure arrives, nearly a third of the global death toll in the first 5 months of a very trying year, what can looking at that one and those 5 zeros tell us? What does any number deployed in momentous times to convey scope and seriousness and thought really mean? We all want to measure these experiences because they're so shocking, so overwhelming that we want to bring some sense of knowability to the unknown, says Jeffrey Jackson, a history professor at Rhodes College in Tennessee, who teaches about the politics of natural disasters. The accuracy of U.S. coronavirus death count has been both a scientific and political issue. Some conservatives have suggested coronavirus deaths were being overcounted. Meanwhile, some researchers say the toll is far more likely to be higher than the count. Here's a look at how deaths are being counted in the U.S. There is no U.S. coronavirus death count that is both current and complete. The most recent death data is gathered through searches of preliminary reports doctors send to state and local health departments. Those numbers appear on different websites, including those of government agencies and some news organizations. One widely followed site is maintained by Johns Hopkins University researchers. But those quick daily tallies ebb and flow for reasons unrelated to when deaths happen. For example, there are fewer reported deaths on weekends when staffing is lower and fewer people are filing reports. Still, they are reasonably accurate, said Robert Anderson of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Many people who died of coronavirus were older and already fragile, weakened by heart disease or some other malady. So ascribing a single cause can be challenging. Experts believe the coronavirus has played an unrecognized role in many deaths, especially soon after the virus arrived in the U.S. That's in part because testing might not have been available or because the virus was not thought to be spreading in an area. In the beginning of any epidemic, where physicians and healthcare workers have less experience with the disease, they're more likely to miss it or misdiagnose it as something else, said Anderson, who oversees the CDC's death statistics work. Over time, reporting improves, he said. For months, most states reported only lab-confirmed cases and deaths, though many places didn't have enough accurate tests available to confirm every one. Last month, the CDC told states to include probable COVID-19 cases in their reports to the agency. Probable coronavirus deaths don't have positive test results, but in which other evidence, like the symptoms and course of their disease and exposure to infected people, points to the infection. Currently, 28 states count only lab-confirmed deaths, while 22 others include probable coronavirus cases, too. CDC officials say they do not know what percentage of reported deaths are lab-confirmed and what percentage are probables. Death certificates are the best source of mortality data because a doctor or medical examiner reviews deaths and may even perform an autopsy before assigning a cause. But it can take a month or more for all the death certificates for a given week to make their way to the CDC. Anderson said his agency is looking both at death certificates that cite coronavirus and looking for deaths that were indirectly caused by the pandemic. Last month, the CDC said the U.S. has seen at least 66,000 more deaths than usual at this point of the year. The new coronavirus was reported as a cause in about half the excess deaths. But Anderson said it's likely the virus was a factor in many other deaths, too. For example, a death certificate might name pneumonia or other coronavirus complications without mentioning the virus. I think there is ample evidence to suggest we are missing some, Anderson said. In other developments, for the first time in history, lawmakers in the U.S. House of Representatives intend to vote by proxy to avoid the risk of travel to Washington during the pandemic. To mark the moment, House Republicans sued to stop the majority party from going ahead. More than one in every six young workers have stopped working during the coronavirus pandemic, the UN Labor Agency reported, warning of long-term fallout that could lead to a lockdown generation if steps aren't taken to ease the crisis. Only about half of Americans say they would get a COVID-19 vaccine if scientists produced one. An additional 31% simply aren't sure, while one in five say they'd refuse. That's according to a survey from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. Latin America is facing increased infections and spiking deaths, according to the World Health Organization. But there's no sign of any slowdown for swindlers in the region, even in the midst of a devastating pandemic. Reports of fraudulent purchases of ventilators, masks, and other medical supplies are piling up. French lawmakers were set to vote Wednesday on whether to endorse a contact tracing app designed to contain the spread of the coronavirus amid sharp debate over privacy concerns. If approved, France's Stop COVID app will be made available to users on a voluntary basis starting Monday. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson refused to hold an official inquiry into the actions of his closest advisor for allegedly flouting lockdown rules, imploring an angry public to move on from the scandal rocking his government. Dominic Cummings drove from London to his parents' house in northeast England while he was falling ill with suspected COVID-19, despite stay-at-home rules that the government had imposed on the rest of the country. Public pools will look very different this summer if they open at all, with the coronavirus threat still looming, as staffers will be tasked with maintaining social distancing and spotting COVID-19 symptoms in addition to their primary duties. Miami Dolphins fans will soon be able to return to Hard Rock Stadium to watch a movie. Months after hosting the Super Bowl, the stadium is converting into both a drive-in and open-air movie theater. The stadium's new drive-in will accommodate up to 230 cars, while the open-air theater offers a more intimate viewing experience on the plaza. Some lucky skiers and snowboarders were able to get back on the mountain at Colorado's only open resort, Arapahoe Basin west of Denver. The resort opened Wednesday with restrictions for 600 snow enthusiasts who earned spots through a random drawing. Bummed out. SpaceX launch scrubbed because of bad weather. The launch of a SpaceX rocket ship with two NASA astronauts on a history-making flight into orbit was called off with less than 17 minutes to go in the countdown Wednesday because of thunderclouds and the risk of lightning. Liftoff was rescheduled for Saturday afternoon. The spacecraft, designed, built, and owned by SpaceX, was set to blast off in the afternoon for the International Space Station, opening a new era in commercial spaceflight. It would have also marked the first time in nearly a decade that the U.S. launched astronauts into orbit from American soil. But thunderstorms for much of the day threatened to force a postponement, and the word finally came down that the atmosphere was so electrically charged that the spacecraft was in danger of getting hit by lightning. NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine said the agency and SpaceX worked together to make the right decision and put safety first at a time when some were wondering whether the public attention surrounding the flight would create undue pressure to launch. Veteran space shuttle astronauts Doug Hurley and Bob Behnken were supposed to ride into orbit aboard SpaceX's sleek, white and black, bullet-shaped Dragon capsule on top of a Falcon 9 rocket, taking off from the same launch pad used during the Apollo moon missions a half century ago. Both President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence had arrived to watch. Trump, who before the postponement marveled at the magnificent rocket on the pad, later tweeted that he will return to Florida for the next try, and the vice president did the same. Thank you at NASA and at SpaceX for their hard work and leadership. Look forward to being back with you on Saturday, Trump said. The flight, the long-held dream of SpaceX founder Elon Musk, would have marked the first time a private company sent humans into orbit. It would have also ended a launch drought for NASA. Ever since the space shuttle was retired in 2011, NASA has relied on Russian spaceships launched from Kazakhstan to take U.S. astronauts to and from the space station. During the day, the rumble of thunder could be heard as the astronauts made their way to the pad at NASA's Kennedy Space Center, and a tornado warning was issued moments after they climbed into their capsule. We could see some raindrops on the windows and just figured that whatever it was too close to the launch pad at the time we needed it not to be, Hurley, the spacecraft commander, said after the flight was scrubbed. Understand that everybody's probably a little bummed out. That's just part of the deal. We'll do it again, I think, on Saturday. Appreciate your resilience sitting there in the vehicle, a controller replied. Behnken responded, nothing better than being prime crew on a new spaceship. The astronauts had to remain strapped in their seats until all the fuel in their rocket was unloaded and the emergency escape system was disarmed. The launch preparations took place in the shadow of the coronavirus outbreak that has killed an estimated 100,000 Americans. With this mission, everybody can look up and say, look, the future is so much brighter than the present. And I really hope that this is an inspiration to the world, Bridenstine said. The flight would put Musk and SpaceX in the same league as only three spacefaring countries, Russia, the U.S., and China, all of which have sent astronauts into orbit. What today is about is reigniting the dream of space and getting people fired up about the future, Musk said in a NASA interview before the postponement. A solemn-sounding Musk said he felt his responsibilities most heavily when he saw the astronauts' wives and young sons just before the launch attempt. He said he told them, we've done everything we can to make sure your dads come back okay. NASA pushed ahead with the preparations despite the viral outbreak, but kept the list at Kennedy extremely limited and asked spectators to stay at home. Still, thousands jammed area bridges and beaches to watch, many of them not wearing masks or observing the 6-foot social distancing rules. The space agency also estimated 1.7 million people were watching the launch preparations online. Among the spectators was Aaron Gatz, who came prepared for both rain and pandemic. Accompanied by her 14-year-old daughter and 12-year-old son, she brought face masks and a small tent. She said the children had faint memories of watching in person one of the last shuttle launches almost a decade ago when they were preschoolers. I wanted them to see the flip side and get to see the next era of space travel, said Gatz, who lives in Deltona, Florida. It's exciting and hopeful. NASA hired SpaceX and Boeing in 2014 to design and build spaceships to carry astronauts to the space station in a new kind of public-private partnership aimed at bringing down costs and spurring innovation. Boeing's capsule, Starliner, is not expected to fly astronauts into space until early 2021. Ultimately, NASA hopes to rely, in part, on its commercial partners as it works to send astronauts back to the moon in the next few years and on to Mars in the 2030s. "We're doing it differently than we've ever done it before," Bridenstine said. "We're transforming how we do spaceflight in the future." Mason City Schools to take part in Summer Food Service Program. Mason City Schools' free lunch program, put into place after classes were suspended due to COVID-19, will end on Wednesday, June 3rd, and transition into the district's annual Summer Food Service Program on Monday, June 8th. The program will run Monday through Friday until August 21st and will be available free to all children on a first-come, first-served basis. Pickup times and locations are as follows. Harding Elementary, 1239 North Rhode Island Avenue. Lunch and snack, 11 to 11:45 a.m. YMCA, 1840 South Monroe Avenue. Lunch, 11:30 a.m. to noon. Snack, 3 to 3:15 p.m. Mason City Parks and Rec, Southbridge Mall, 100 South Delaware Ave. Lunch, 11:45 a.m. to 12:15 p.m. Snack, 3 to 3:15 p.m. For more information, call School Community Relations at 641-421-4401. Clear Lake announces the start of mosquito spraying. The city of Clear Lake will begin spraying for mosquitoes this week. The spraying will take place between Monday evening and Saturday morning, depending on the weather, including precipitation and wind speed. City staff will spray starting at 7 p.m. and continue as long as temperatures and wind speeds are acceptable, which is less than 10 miles per hour. Spraying may resume at 4 a.m. and end at approximately 7 a.m. Spraying will continue throughout the summer and fall as long as mosquito population counts justify the spraying. If anyone doesn't want the spraying to occur on their property, they must call Operations and Maintenance Supervisor Jeremy Kornberg at 641-357-6135. The city will also be spraying on the South Shore, Grandview Point, Bell Harbor, Dodges Point, Whispering Oaks, and Camp Tanglefoot. Additional information about the city's mosquito spraying program can be found on the City of Clear Lake's website at cityofclearlake.com. Sarah Gordo's daily COVID-19 update. What isn't open. Precautions for older vulnerable adults. Wednesday, May 27th, data snapshot. 18,273 total lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Iowa. 22 total lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Cerro Gordo. 488 deaths in Iowa. 1 death in Cerro Gordo. 3,391 COVID-19 tests administered at the mobile testing unit. A status report of monitoring and testing of COVID-19 in Iowa, including county-level data, provided by the Iowa Department of Public Health, can be found at coronavirus.iowa.gov. Breaking down the most recent proclamation, what is open, what is not. The most recent proclamation signed by Governor Reynolds on May 26th is 35 pages long and filled with many updates regarding changes to the status of businesses allowed to reopen or their provisions set by the governor. Below is a breakdown of the proclamation to ensure the public has a clear picture of what will be open as of May 28th and June 1st and what will remain closed. Businesses to open May 28th. Restaurants and bars, including wedding reception venues, wineries, breweries, distilleries, country clubs, and other social or fraternal clubs. Requirements: 50% capacity, group size seating of 10 or less people, no self-serving of food, including buffets or salad bars. Live performances are allowed. businesses to open June 1st at 50% capacity, racetracks with spectators, outdoor performance venues, casinos and gaming facilities, amusements including bingo halls, bowling alleys, pool halls, arcades, and amusement parks, indoor and outdoor skating rinks and skate parks, outdoor playgrounds. The reopening of the playgrounds varies city to city. Check with your city to see their plan to reopen outdoor playgrounds and restrooms. Businesses and establishments to remain closed. Indoor theater and performance venues at which live performances occur. Senior citizen and adult daycare facilities. Indoor playgrounds. JIC strongly encourages older adults to limit activities outside of home. Older adults age 65 years or older and those with underlying conditions such as diabetes are considered high risk for COVID-19. 8 out of 10 deaths reported in the United States have been in adults 65 years old and older, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. To protect yourself, the CDC has provided specific guidance to ensure you stay safe during the pandemic. Below are steps of how you can reduce your risk of becoming ill. Stay home if possible and limit trips to businesses and other establishments. Wash your hands often. Avoid close contact and stay at least 6 feet, about 2 arms lengths, from other people. Clean and disinfect frequently touched surfaces. Shoot for twice a day. Wear a cloth face mask or covering. If you cannot locate or make one, call the COVID-19 call center at 641-494-3543. Cover coughs and sneezes with your upper arm or tissue. We cannot stress enough how important it is to practice the steps above to protect yourself. This may be an isolating and stressful time, so support yourself by connecting with others. Take breaks from watching, reading, or listening to the news. If you or someone you care about are feeling overwhelmed with emotions like sadness, depression, or anxiety, or feel like you want to harm yourself or others, call 855-581-8111. If you begin to feel ill, call the Mercy One Family Health Line at 641-428-7777 to undergo an initial phone screening. For more information on those needing to take extra precautions, visit cdc.gov. Cerro Gordo's Relay for Life going virtual in June. The American Cancer Society has suspended all face-to-face Relay for Life events in 2020 as a safety precaution in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. That means the Relay for Life of Cerro Gordo County event on Friday evening at Clear Lake City Park will not be held as scheduled. The safety of our cancer survivors and stakeholders is of utmost priority, Relay for Life of Cerro Gordo County Committee said in a press release. Although people are unable to gather amid the COVID-19 pandemic, the American Cancer Society will host virtual Relay for Life events, initiatives, and activities during the month of June. June will be Relay for Life Month in Cerro Gordo County, the committee announced. Throughout the month, the committee plans to honor and remember the many cancer survivors whose journeys have shaped its passion to take a stand and fight back to cancer, as well as acknowledge the important work of Relay for Life patrons, including survivors, teams, coaches versus cancer participants, sponsors, and volunteers. Full details and information will be released in the coming days. Education, awareness, and prevention of cancer remain at the forefront of our efforts, the committee said. We thank you for your interest and support in the fight against cancer. Cancer hasn't stopped, and neither will we. Organizers put the brakes on Clear Lake's Bicycle, Blues, and Barbecue Festival in 2020. A day after Clear Lake announced the cancellation of its 2020 4th of July celebration events due to COVID-19, another popular summer event has been called off this year. The Bicycle Blues and Barbecue Festival and the Brews on the Beach Craft Beer Festival, scheduled for July 10th through the 12th, have been canceled, the organizers announced Wednesday morning on social media. As a small volunteer organization, we just do not feel we could reasonably hold the BB BBQ festival events while also following public health guidelines, said Tim Putnam, festival director, and Matt Curtis, race director, in a Facebook post. The festival, a jam-packed weekend with bicycles, blues, barbecue, and brews, attracts thousands of visitors, including 350 cyclists from 15 states to North Iowa. The events are made possible by more than 150 volunteers who are responsible for keeping athletes safe and managing the weekend's events. This all adds up to nearly 10,000 who come into one central location in Clear Lake, and we just know we would not be able to provide the needed protocols that would give everyone the confidence of a safe and healthy environment, the post continued. With this, we choose to err on the side of public safety and canceled this year's planned events. The festival was started 16 years ago and has grown in participants and offerings. Proceeds from the Bicycle Blues and Barbecue Festival support improving the healthy lifestyle through bicycle-related activities to include creating and improving bicycle trails, bicycle safety training, supporting cycling events and activities, and improving the amenities related to cycling. Brews on the Beach, which is hosted by Lake Time Brewery, was added to the Bicycle Blues and BBQ Festival in 2015. Last year's event drew nearly 1,000 people to the beach to enjoy 30 Iowa craft breweries and their finest brews. The Bicycle Blues and BBQ and Brews on the Beach festivals will return to Clear Lake on July 9th through the 11th, 2021. For more information about the Bicycle Blues and BBQ Festival, visit bicycleBluesBBQ.com or follow the Bicycle Blues and BBQ Facebook page. Bobby Schilling's son under fire for homophobic, transphobic tweets. The son of Bobby Schilling, Republican primary candidate for Iowa's 2nd Congressional District, is coming under fire for posting homophobic and transphobic comments on Twitter. Terry Schilling, 33, announced May 21st he would be taking over his father's campaign after Bobby announced he was diagnosed with cancer and undergoing treatment. In a now-deleted tweet from May 22nd, 2019, Terry Schilling wrote, "I have zero problem explaining heterosexual sex to my kids if they ask. It's how babies are made. Am I really a snowflake for not wanting to explain butt sex to my kids? Dad, can two dads have kids together? Why do they get married? How do they have kids? Yes, two dads can get married and can have kids, but they have to hire a woman to implant an embryo in her uterus and carry the baby to term. Then the two dads take the baby away from the mom, just like a puppy. Is this the conversation I should have with my kids?" Schilling wrote. "Parents, you're not snowflakes for not wanting to explain the sordid world of gay couples who really don't get married anyway." Same-sex marriage was legalized in the state of Iowa on April 3, 2009. The U.S. Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage in all 50 states in June 2015. A Twitter user by the handle of @Dawall, D-A-W-A-L-L, reposted the tweets on Monday and tagged Terry Schilling, saying, "Weird, some of your best tweets have gone missing. That's okay, we archived a few." Terry replied the same day to @Dawall, "I will give you even better ones in the future," and added a hashtag, #WomenCanHavePenises. He followed with one more tweet, "Would you like me to send some really offensive ones right now? I can get some good ones going." Terry lives in Northern Virginia with his wife and five children. He is executive director of the American Principles Project. The APP lists among its founding principles the union of one man and one woman as the definition of marriage, and recognition of the reality of human beings as divided into two distinct and complementary biological sexes. On February 1st, Terry tweeted, "Why do trans people pick the dumbest names after they transition?" The tweet was deleted Monday, but when Twitter user @TheJimmyFeeney retweeted a screenshot of it, Terry replied, "I'm going to develop a trans name generator. We'll send to you once the site is up. Will be a ton of fun." Terry said Wednesday that he stands behind his comments. "I don't regret anything," he said. "It's all truth, and it's how most Americans feel." Terry explained that as executive director for the APP, he is concerned with how sex education is being taught in schools and the influence it has on children. He said his group is working toward legislation that will regulate online pornography and implement age restrictions, making it harder for children to access. "What we're building is the NRA for families," he said, "just like how the National Rifle Association organizes gun owners in public policy and politics to protect their rights. We are organizing families and parents to protect their rights in public policy and make it easier to raise children and to protect your children." Terry said his goal is to protect children from really bad curriculum being taught in schools, including homosexuality, how to change your gender, and teaching kids how to masturbate. Really graphic stuff we should be keeping away from kids. "Obviously, I was trying to be descriptive and really drive home the point of what we're getting at. I regularly clean up my Twitter and delete everything that's older than a few months because I don't want to be taken out of context in the future," Terry said. 10 years from now, people are going to read it and they're not going to understand what it means. They're going to think that I'm being serious. Lots of people clean up their Twitter on a regular basis. Terry doesn't think his social media comments will negatively impact his father's campaign. "My positions and my tweets have nothing to do with my dad's public policy platform," Terry said. "Although I will tell you, he is very concerned about what our kids are learning in school and doesn't think they should be learning how to masturbate. It's really important we keep our kids pure for as long as possible. The only way this would have a negative impact on the campaign is if voters actually want their kids to learn about very offensive forms of sexuality and being taught how to masturbate in school. That's the only way this will reflect poorly. I'm not worried about it. It is a conservative primary. If you want your kids learning about homosexual sex and learning how to masturbate in school, by all means, vote for the Democrat. Vote for opponent Marionette Miller Meeks." Terry said his tweets are not homophobic. "I have many gay friends. I love them all," he said. "I hang out with them. I've had beers with them. I've smoked cigarettes with them. Most of my gay friends don't think kids should be learning about this stuff in school either, which is why I feel even more confident this is not going to backfire or be a negative for the campaign. I am a Catholic. I believe every human life should be protected regardless of sexual orientation, regardless of gender. Every human being is a child of God, regardless of what they do. We have to protect our kids, and I'm not going to compromise." You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Wednesday, May 27th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Betty J. Folk, born April 26th, 1930, died May 21st, 2020. Betty Jean Folk, 90, formerly of Rockford, died on Thursday, May 21st, at the Stuartville Care Center in Stuartville, Minnesota, of natural causes. Due to COVID-19 concerns, only a graveside service will be held at 3 p.m. on Wednesday, May 27th, at Sunnyside Memory Garden in Charles City. Pastor Dennis Burns from the First United Methodist Church in Rockford will be officiating. Betty was born on April 26, 1930, in Charles City, to Arlie and Angie Huffman Shannon. She was raised by her mother Angie and stepfather Carl Simerson. Betty attended school and graduated from Nashua High School. On August 28, 1948, she was united in marriage to Ori Ralph Folk in Waverly. After raising her three children, she became a waitress and cook and started volunteering. After the kids grew up, she started long-haul trucking with her husband and did that for over 20 years. When they retired, she became a certified nursing assistant for in-home care. Betty was a member of the First United Methodist Church in Rockford and served many years as a community and church volunteer. Before moving to Minnesota, Betty focused on volunteering, including foster grandparents, and received state recognition for her contributions. Those left to cherish her memory include her son, Lynn and Keong C. Folk of Hawaii, daughter-in-law, Diane Folk and spouse Carl of Slater, son-in-law, Gene Rentz of Stuartville, Minnesota, and many grandchildren and great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, Ori Folk, son, Carl Folk, daughter, Marlis Rentz, and daughter-in-law, Chioko Folk. Doris B. Fritz, born May 24, 1926, died May 24, 2020. Doris Bunette Lind Fritz entered the room Jesus had prepared for her on May 24, 2020, on her 94th birthday. She left this world peacefully, surrounded by the love of her family. A private graveside service will be held in Memorial Park Cemetery. Doris was born May 24, 1926, on the Lind family farm in Franklin County, near Coulter. Doris was the daughter of Harry and Sophia Hansen Lind and the twin sister of Delos Lind. She was baptized and confirmed at Nazareth Lutheran Church in Coulter. Doris attended country school and graduated from Hampton High School in 1944. She graduated from Dana College in Blair, Nebraska in the two-year teaching program with additional studies at Luther College in Decorah. She taught school for Alexander and Cal Community Schools for several years. While at Luther College, Doris met John Fritz, and they were married in Coulter on August 17, 1950. They both taught school in Charles City for 3 years. In 1953, they moved to Mason City, where she taught at Harding Elementary. After the arrival of her children, she dedicated her life to being a wife, mother, homemaker, and volunteer. John continued his career as art department chairman for the Mason City Schools and art instructor at Mason City Junior College, later becoming the principal of Washington and Jefferson Elementary Schools. Doris and John were active, committed members of Trinity Lutheran Church, and assisting John with Christmas decorations was her specialty. Doris enjoyed singing in the choir, teaching Bible school, being a circle member, and serving as TLCW president. Doris was involved in many civic organizations, including serving on the YWCA, MC Women's Club, Community Concert Board, and the first KCMR Board. She also served for years on the Charles H. McNider Arts Council. Doris especially loved attending concerts and stage presentations, playing the piano, tending to her flower gardens, entertaining in their home, traveling to visit their children, and vacationing in Arizona and California. Her talent for entertaining was legendary. Her Danish heritage, coupled with the enjoyment she took in creating many traditional Scandinavian desserts and pastries, made holidays amazing and memorable for everyone who visited her home. Special to her were her many relatives, PEO sisters, and treasured friends. Her beautiful smile and gentle spirit will be greatly missed by her husband, family, and all who knew and loved her. Doris is survived by her husband, John, of nearly 70 years, and two children, Charles Fritz and partner Carol Hagen of Billings, Montana, and Cheryl Fritz of Mason City. Also surviving are her brother, Daryl Lind, and wife, Marilyn, of Mason City, sister-in-law, Arla Mae Lind of Hampton, and two grandchildren, Isaac and Eric Fritz of Billings, Montana, many nieces, nephews, and great-nieces and nephews. Doris was preceded in death by her parents, Harry and Sophia Hansen Lind, her twin brother, Delos, and nephew, David Lind. The family would like to thank the kind staff of the IOOF home who have cared for Doris so lovingly for the past 2 years and continue to care for John. In lieu of flowers, memorials in her name may be made to the Trinity Lutheran Church Robert Dutcher Scholarship Fund or Charles H. McNider Museum. Any cards for the family can be sent to Major Erickson Funeral Home, 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue. Online condolences may be left for the family at majorericksonfuneralhome.com, and Erickson is spelled E-R-I-C-K-S-O-N. Robert M. Quayle. Born April 1, 1933, died May 23, 2020. Robert Bob Mason Quayle, 87, of Forest City, passed away on Saturday, May 23rd, after battling cancer. In lieu of a funeral service, a celebration of life will be held with family at a later date. Robert was born April 1, 1933, to Lester Jim and Agnes Johnson Quayle. He was the older of two sons. He graduated from Forest City High School in 1950. He married Lorraine Jewell on July 24, 1955, after he completed military service in Germany. They raised four children, Dick, Carmen, Beth, and Annette, on their dairy farm south of Forest City. Bob loved to keep busy between working on the farm, Winnebago Industries, and also Wednesday nights at the sale barn for several years. He had a full life filled with family, friends, cribbage, playing cards, hunting and fishing, and finding bargains. He enjoyed any kind of animal, fishing trips to Canada, driving trams at pucker brush days, square dancing, and bluegrass festivals. His quiet faith with Jesus was important to him. He attended First Baptist Church of Forest City with his family. He embraced life to the fullest in his own unique way, making for many good stories to tell. His legacy will continue with his 4 children, 15 grandchildren, and 14 great-grandchildren. Cards can be sent to the family at 2575 Sockum Ridge Road, and Sockum is spelled S-O-C-K-U-M, Washington, Iowa, 52353. The family would like memorial donations to go to Hospice of Washington County. 2 medical marijuana companies eyeing Coralville dispensary opening. 2 medical marijuana companies involved in Iowa's flagging medical marijuana program are competing to open a dispensary in Coralville. The Des Moines-based MedFarm Iowa and Waterloo-based Iowa Cannabis Company are seeking a medical cannabidiol dispensary license in Coralville from the Iowa Department of Public Health. Coralville Mayor John Lundell has written a letter of support for MedFarm Iowa, and Coralville City Administrator Kelly Hayworth has written one for Iowa Cannabis Company, though Lundell and Hayworth said they don't have a preference for which company gets the license. MedFarm Iowa is the state's only licensed manufacturer of cannabis products currently operating. Acreage Holdings temporarily closed its Iowa Relief medical marijuana manufacturing facility in southwest Cedar Rapids in April at the height of the coronavirus pandemic. MedPharma also operates dispensaries in Windsor Heights and Sioux City, according to the company's general manager, Lucas Nelson. Iowa Cannabis Company operates a dispensary in Waterloo. Hayworth said both companies sought dispensary licenses for Coralville in 2018, but were unsuccessful. "We were fine with it," Hayworth said of supporting either company. "We were fine with it 2 years ago. The council saw no issue in it. We just felt it was important to support whatever businesses wanted to do it." Hayworth said he is not aware where either company would locate a dispensary if approved for a license. Nelson said he wouldn't disclose a potential location. A representative from Iowa Cannabis was not available Tuesday for comment. But Nelson said his company's preferred location is easily accessible and would be a really ideal spot for us. Nelson said there are numerous reasons why Coralville has been on his company's radar. "It's got a population we know is interested in medical cannabis," he said. He also noted Coralville's close relationship with the medical field and said a dispensary there would offer opportunities to University of Iowa researchers and others. MedPharm Iowa manufactures medical marijuana tinctures, creams, and capsules, as well as vaporization devices, Nelson said. The products are available in each of Iowa's remaining 3 dispensaries, Windsor Heights, Waterloo, and Sioux City, as required by Iowa law. The state currently is trying to fill 2 licenses created by the closure of dispensaries in Davenport and Council Bluffs earlier this year. With 2 of the state's 5 licensed dispensaries closed, Nelson said he hopes the request for proposal process will result in 2 really strong operators and will end up with a very robust market again. "I think the biggest benefit it provides to us and the other current operator in Waterloo is some reassurance the program is not going to crater out there," he said. Nelson said the dispensary proposals are due June 8th, and he expects a decision on licenses in late July. While his company is eligible to apply for a second license at another location, Nelson said the company is focusing on Coralville. MedPharm Iowa also has received a letter of support from the Iowa City Area Business Partnership. The Johnson County Board of Supervisors is scheduled to discuss MedPharm Iowa's request for a letter of support during Wednesday's work session. Northwest Iowa County with meat plant sees coronavirus spike. A northwest Iowa county that is home to a meatpacking plant has seen nearly 500 coronavirus cases in the past week, but state officials in the company said Wednesday they couldn't confirm an outbreak at the facility. The state health department reported 678 cases since Wednesday in Buena Vista County, where a Tyson pork processing plant is located in Storm Lake. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said the state hasn't confirmed an outbreak related to the plant, but that testing is underway to make sure we are understanding the scope of what that is and how we can start to isolate those testing positive. Tyson spokeswoman Liz Croston said the company and local health officials have conducted large-scale testing in Storm Lake and will disclose verified test results once complete data is available. State officials haven't always publicly released meat processing plant outbreaks unless they're asked specifically about certain locations by reporters, as was the case with recent outbreaks at a Purdue Farms pork processing facilities in Sioux City and Sioux Center. "We've been announcing them at these press conferences as the questions have been asked," said Sarah Reistetter, deputy director of the Iowa Department of Public Health. "The department doesn't consider that a company has had an outbreak until at least 10% of employees have tested positive for the coronavirus," Reistetter said. "Sometimes it takes us a little bit of time to pull together the information to understand whether there has been an outbreak in a particular facility," she said. Iowa health data indicated 595 new positive cases statewide on Wednesday, for a total of 18,256 known cases of coronavirus infection. The state reported 21 more deaths, for a total of 485 deaths. Reynolds defends state's COVID data reporting. Governor Kim Reynolds and a top state public health official said Wednesday the contact tracing information gathering process is one reason the state does not voluntarily identify new coronavirus outbreaks at businesses like food processing plants until asked by media members. Not immediately announcing outbreaks also gives those business owners time to notify employees and community members themselves, the state official said. State Public Health Deputy Director Sarah Reistetter on Tuesday confirmed outbreaks at Purdue Premium Meat Company plants in Sioux City and Sioux Center after a reporter asked about potential outbreaks during the governor's daily briefing on the state's pandemic response. During Wednesday's briefing, Reistetter and Reynolds explained why the state is not automatically reporting such outbreaks and instead confirms them only after being asked by reporters about specific outbreaks. "Sometimes it takes us a little bit of time to pull together the information and to understand whether there's been an outbreak in a particular facility," Reistetter said Wednesday. "It also provides an opportunity for the business to independently, outside of having to do it at a press conference, to notify their communities, as Purdue Farms did. It gave them the opportunity to take the lead in making that notification." Reistetter also said state public health officials interview people with confirmed cases and contact any individuals who may have come in contact with them. Confirmed coronavirus cases spiked by more than 400 on Tuesday in Buena Vista County, home to two Tyson processing plants. Reistetter said Wednesday that the department could not yet confirm any outbreaks there. State Auditor Rob Sand weighed in Wednesday, issuing a statement that called for full transparency from Reynolds' administration. "In order for Iowans and public officials across the state to make good decisions about health and safety, they need current data and facts. The public deserves full transparency from the governor's office and from the Iowa Department of Public Health that isn't contingent upon reporters asking," Sand said in a statement. When asked how Iowans can know that they need to properly protect themselves from the virus's spread if they're not notified about potential outbreaks in their communities, Reynolds said there may be a way for the state to work with local public health partners to inform residents when outbreaks occur. The governor also defended her administration's transparency in its pandemic response efforts. "We are really trying very hard to provide Iowans with an incredible amount of data to be as transparent as possible," Reynolds said. "We can always do better. We're always looking at the information we're getting, making sure that we're protecting the privacy of Iowans while trying to provide Iowans with the information that they need to also ensure their safety." Reynolds noted Iowa's coronavirus data transparency was graded A+ by the COVID Tracking Project, a volunteer project launched by The Atlantic. The project's grading system includes such factors as whether the state's central website is the best data source, whether both positive and negative test results are reported, whether hospitalization data includes data on the number of people in intensive care and on ventilators, and whether cases and deaths are broken down by demographics. Iowa's was one of 12 A-plus grades given by the project. Only 10 states were graded C or worse. Neighboring Nebraska was given one of the D grades. Iowa state officials on Wednesday confirmed 21 new virus-related deaths, contributing to a continued steady climb in the 7-day average of daily new virus-related deaths in the state. The state averaged 15 new deaths per day over the previous week and is approaching 500 total deaths. Current virus-related hospitalizations continued to plateau, and new admissions continued a downward trend. Officials, Iowa woman found dead, died of natural causes. A more than month-long investigation has shown that a woman found dead inside her house near Grimes died of natural causes, the Polk County Sheriff's Office said Wednesday. The Sheriff's Office made the pronouncement in a news release on the death of 35-year-old Melanie Schuring. Schuring was found dead in her house on April 19th after deputies, firefighters, and medics were called to the home. Schuring's 46-year-old fiancé was also at the home. Other than to declare her death was from natural causes, officials did not say Wednesday what caused Schuring's death. Those prepaid debit cards in the mail are not a scam. If you're looking for your federal stimulus money, officials with the U.S. Department of the Treasury want you to know the prepaid debit card, not a check, is in the mail. Last week, federal officials began mailing out government prepaid debit cards to individuals qualifying for up to $1,200 in federal stimulus money included in the $2 trillion CARES Act legislation. But officials worry there is little public notice, and Iowans are mistaking the cards as a scam or junk mail and throwing them away, not knowing their value. Many people thought these cards were a scam or a solicitation, and they tossed them in the trash, said Lynn Hicks of the Iowa Attorney General's office. Right now, we're trying to get the word out to people, he said. Don't throw it away if you receive it, and be aware of the fine print. Hicks said the IRS apparently is sending the economic impact payment debit cards to qualifying Iowans who either have not given their banking information to the IRS or have some other obstacle to receiving the money via direct deposit. The cards must be activated by phone or online before they can be used. The Visa card arrives in an envelope from Money Network Cardholder Services with MetaBank on the back and has instructions to activate it by calling a phone number and providing a Social Security number, Hicks said. We've been telling people to be careful who you give your Social Security number to, he noted, so a lot of people thought it was a scam or a solicitation. Hicks said the AG's office has been getting about 15 calls a day since last Wednesday about the cards. I don't think people realized that this is the way that they would be getting it, said Hicks, who had just finished talking to an older woman Tuesday who couldn't remember whether she received it or not. People are having trouble. They'll call their bank to transfer it to their bank account, and the banks don't know what this is about. That's what they're saying anyway. There's just a lot of confusion, and some people are at a dead end, Hicks said. Even if people kept the card and are trying to use it, some people are having frustration with that. The prepaid debit cards are supposed to be easy to use to get cash from automated transfer machines, transfer funds to a personal bank account, and make online and retail location purchases where Visa cards are accepted. They can check their card balance online or by phone without any fees, according to the Internal Revenue Service. However, Hicks said some people say they have incurred fees or must pay $7.50 to get a new card issued, $17 if they want it expedited, if they have mistakenly discarded, lost, or misplaced the debit cards. Also, he said, people are having trouble getting a hold of anybody when they seek IRS assistance, and there's a lot of fine print that people need to read with this card to avoid fees and things like that as well. Hicks said his office is directing Iowans to eipcard.com or consumerfinance.gov/about-us/blog/ economic-impact-payment-prepaid-card for assistance. The problem is, he said, many people are having trouble getting through, and the automatic message is asking for the number on the card, which they don't have. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Wednesday, May 27th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.